Hello, and you're very welcome to The Long Short. It's been almost 2 years to the day since global central banks embarked on one of the swiftest and most synchronized rapid monetary tightening cycles in modern-day economic history, the aim to tame runaway higher levels of inflation, which were experienced globally in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic.
The US experienced 15 months of interest rate hikes starting from around zero to over 5% between mid-2022 and mid-2023. This marked the Federal Reserve's most aggressive rate hike cycle in over 40 years, fueling wild volatility in stocks, bonds, commodities, and other asset classes.
And here in the UK, the economy also felt the brunt of higher rates, with the Bank of England raising interest rates over 14 consecutive times to 5.25% as the cost of living soared and mortgage holders suffered.
And there's been a similar outcome elsewhere, including in the EU and in major countries in APAC, all of which have had to endure higher interest rates.
And while indications are that the worst may be over, central banks caution that they may need to keep rates higher for longer to ensure stability.
With central bank policy changes, rising government debt, and geopolitical tensions all stirring the pot, global financial markets will continue to face significant challenges. And amid this period of uncertainty, the case for active asset management is stronger than ever. Focusing on investment fundamentals is simply crucial.
Global macro and trend following strategies can play an important role in investment portfolios due to their flexibility and historic strong performance during inflationary and risk-off periods like being currently experienced. And joining us today to talk through what is likely to be another fascinating year in global markets is Anna McCutcheon, co-founder of Shakuma Capital. Anna, you are very welcome to The Long Short.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Anna, as we approach the end of the first quarter of this year, what are you seeing in global market behavior and how investors are managing portfolio risk?
Well, I think last year was obviously a year that was quite focused on the Fed behavior, the rate hikes, and people were very focused on the micro aspect of what's going to happen from month to month, which led to a lot of volatility. I think this year we've gotten to a stage now where the Fed has given indications that they are in a holding pattern and waiting for a sign as to what might be a reason for them to then start to lower rates. And I think the important thing now is to kind of zoom the lens out a bit. And my sense is that it's going to be a year that is more sideways moving, and there's going to be some, you know, volatility in there. But of course, we've got that in the backdrop of, you know, many elections happening globally, as you said in your introduction. And I think from a portfolio perspective, when it comes to managing risk, you know, right now, if you were to just use typical portfolio insurance, you know, through options and whatnot, that's quite an expensive way to hedge your portfolio. And it's not a very effective way because we've been in such a low volatility environment that we're not really seeing that kind of approach being very effective as a hedge to the portfolio. And another way, perhaps, probably diversification is going to be a good way to try to mitigate some of the risks in the markets, because at least we don't have the same kind of correlations that we were seeing across all markets in the past. Gold is obviously rallying right now, as is Bitcoin, and those will continue to be places I think you'll see investors putting their money, because it provides some kind of security when there's uncertainty in the market. So it's a movement to seek safe harbor. But equally, it is a very strong comment on the debasement that is happening in currencies across the world, but in particular in the US dollar, which is a result of the unending money printing that we've seen in the behavior of the federal banks, the central banks around the world. So I think we'll continue to see people looking more and more to these sorts of things to kind of at least diversify their portfolio away from whether it's US dollar or just away from equity markets in general, or the bond markets for that matter. My personal take on an interesting way to think about hedging the portfolio is actually in the form of cybersecurity, because as we go steaming into this exponential growth of the ever-present AI, and it becomes more and more a part of our lives at a rate of change that it's very hard to get our heads around, a big part of what's going to be impacted is the infiltration by the hackers of the world into, you know, this IT infrastructures of various businesses and you know, agencies. And that risk is not going to go away. If anything, it's going to grow. I think companies every year are spending more and more on this area. And so given that cybersecurity is increasing part of the day-to-day lives of running a business, and that generative AI is becoming a feature, that's going to be used by, you know, the people wanting to infiltrate companies, and equally those companies that are using AI to combat that. I think that's going to be just a natural growth area. And so even, and to some extent, resilient from what's happening in the greater markets. So if you wanted to have a bit of an orthogonal take on things, there'll be aspects within the markets that are specific to what to the world that we're living in now, and perhaps enhanced by AI, that could be an interesting place to park, you know, some portion of your portfolio that would be a little bit more immune to what's happening in the greater world.
It's fascinating that you say cybersecurity as an answer there, and I really want to sort of unpack that a little bit further. But just to set the scene a little bit further, because there is so much going on this year, and just to give listeners an idea, we're recording this on the 21st of March, and so we've just had the latest signal from the US and the UK as it comes to interest rates, and Bitcoin has just had its first correction after the recent hike. So there's so much going on, and people are recalibrating all the time to sort of feed this information in. Could you just help me and our listeners understand sort of what the top three macro events are? We've got elections, interest rates, everything else in between.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly, I think ultimately what everybody's watching still is this, the big concern is what happens to interest rates from here. And so as it stands, the messaging coming up from the Fed is still that they've got your back, in the sense that, you know, they have given indications that they are not thinking of hiking at the moment. They are looking for some kind of signal from the market that would give them a reason to start lowering rates. But you've got to remember that the Fed, ultimately, they're not going to be in a huge rush to want to let rates down, because that is their defense mechanism for making corrections or taking action when it is necessary to do so. So if, you know, obviously when we were in an environment when rates were near zero, their hands were tied. And so now they've got some buffer, which is good for them. And to the extent that the economy is still showing itself to be resilient, you know, they're not really in a hurry to take the rates back down. I think the one thing that and you've seen, of course, you know, the CPI numbers that have come recently, the market's just, you know, it was kind of a so what moment. But the one thing that could perhaps change the Fed's viewpoint is the labor market. If the labor market were to become tighter again, that might be an indication that they need to actually raise rates a little bit more. And I think that would be one thing that could change, you know, create a lot more volatility in the markets. We could see a much bigger sell-off than we would have otherwise expected. So that's obviously what the Fed does is important. And frankly, I think, you know, yes, the other central banks have their own views on things. Of course, you've got the Bank of Japan, who's just moved itself out of a negative rate environment into a slightly positive environment. But those are minutiae movements. You know, it really take something much bigger. You know, the rates going from where they are now, I think, is 0.1, you know, 10 basis points, the Bank of Japan's recent change. If it were to move up to sort of like the 1 to 2% level, that would have a much bigger impact on global markets, because of course the Japanese investors are the whales in the global bond markets, and you know, that would probably be a reason for a lot of Japanese to repatriate their money back, and that would of course then have an impact on US treasuries and whatnot. But we're nowhere near there at this stage, and so I think still it's the case that everybody's ultimately watching the Fed and what they do. So that would be one of the big global events or macro events that people are focusing on this year. The second one, of course, is the elections globally everywhere. But the ultimate elections, I think, that are still going to be important are the US elections. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, later in the call. But there's going to be the big question of how AI is playing a role in what we see everywhere in election campaigning, in reporting on social media and what have you, because it's going to have a, you know, there's going to be an element of uncertainty everywhere, given the role that AI could potentially have there. And then thirdly, you know, obviously the geopolitics, what's happening in the world. We've got, of course, the Ukraine, what happens in the US elections is going to potentially have an impact there. We've got what's happening in the Middle East, and to what extent, you know, Iran does or doesn't get more involved on that level and create a wider, you know, global event in that sense. And then I think just generally we've got these heady markets where you know, we're seeing levels of pricing in the likes, of course, of Nvidia and some of these other tech companies that have just, they're not explainable. And I think what we're seeing is we're going through this kind of similar sort of era that we had in the internet boom and the tech boom before that, whereby there's these changes in dynamics and people are struggling to get their heads around, is this a secular change that we have to think about valuing things differently? Or is it just that this is a massive bubble? And there'll be a lot of questioning around that. And given how much, you know, those companies are driving, say, the S&P, and given the extent to which now so much, there's such a broader effect of investing in the US markets, but, you know, more globally, whereby passive investing is becoming a much bigger part of that. And so hence is watching and being affected by things like the S&P. So there's a very big component of the tail wagging the dog here. So to the extent that there's any uncertainty around those sorts of things, I think we could see some volatility. And I'm not really speaking too much to what's happening, you know, in bond markets, apart from mentioning, you know, the Japan effect, but that's not really my domain. So I won't sort of speak to that in any kind of convincing way.
And I'm fascinated by all of this, in particular the race to the bottom. Well, that's what I'm calling it anyway, the race to the bottom when it comes to central bank policy changes. There is that feeling, certainly, and I guess from my perspective, I'm hoping that it is turning out to be true, that the monetary tightening cycle is coming to an end. If that be the case, then I guess the $60,000 question is, who do you think is likely to cut rates first amongst the three main central banks? Would it be the Bank of England? Would it be the Federal Reserve in the US? Or would it be the ECB?
Well, I'm a cynic in the sense that, I mean, I do, obviously we have seen some independence between the central banks in the last couple of years. But at this stage, my guess is that everybody follows the Fed. Now, the Fed in and of itself, I think they have, you know, they can't be seen to be political. I think ultimately they are political, because I think it's at a stage now where markets have become such a big part of the economy and of people's savings, and you've got this massive the demographics globally, but particularly, you know, if we're just talking about the US, a lot of people now have a big portion of their savings invested in markets. And so what happens in the markets has an impact on the broader economy for that reason. Now the Fed is not going to want to be too active as we get into and close to the US elections. And you've got a certain limited number of FOMC meetings from now until the end of the year. And I think for that reason, the Fed, if they're going to do anything, it will be probably in the June, July timeframe. It may be May, but it's going to be well enough in advance of what's happening in the, you know, September, November time when the US elections are taking place. And I think, you know, even if you look at, you know, the CPI numbers came out yesterday and you know, that there's, you know, some, you know, senior economists are saying, well, you know, it might be that we could see the Bank of England lower rates sometime in the summer, which happens to coincide with that same timeframe. So that for me just says, you know, in other words, they're going to follow the Fed. And I think this the same is the case with, you know, Lagarde and the ECB. I think ultimately the moves that they're going to make are not going to be as big as they're not going to move the markets as much as what the Fed does will. And I think that's probably what we're going to see.
Okay, so sustained pain for mortgage bond holders is basically what I'm hearing. Okay.
Yeah, and I think, as I said earlier, like I think the only thing that would probably create volatility in what the Fed does is if we see some kind of tightness in the labor markets. That's not at the moment being seen in the numbers. I don't think the numbers are showing that right now. But you know, if that were to change quickly, then that could be a reason that we'd see some volatility going into the summer.
You've mentioned already that this year is being billed as, you know, the big year of elections, and I think it's something like nearly half the world's population, or you know, 100 countries are going to the polls this year. And when I think about elections compared to maybe central bank activity, you know, as you just outlined it, it seems like elections are far harder to predict, because you know, sort of it's one thing to get it right, but you've got to get it right, and to what extent are you right, and then you've got to predict what getting it right means, whether it swings one way or the other, and how you're gonna you know, build your portfolio accordingly. So just sort of very simply, as a macro investor facing such a huge, you know, you've just got to get these big calls right as much as possible. How do you even go about that?
Well, so as you say, that there are, you know, I think over, I mean, some elections have already taken place. In March, we've had, I think, Iran and Russia. But, you know, on the one hand, you've got some countries that are like the two I just mentioned, you know, they're autocracies. And so the outcome of the elections, even with AI, I think the outcome is fairly unambiguous, or at least, you know, no one is expecting there to be major changes there. And ultimately, I think, is from an investment perspective, you know, unless you have a particular type of trade that you're trying to put on around some kind of events, like in elections in other parts of the world, you know, the main elections this year that are going to be the game changers is going to be the US elections. And in fact, I take away that word game changer, because ultimately I think that whoever wins the US election is probably unlikely to be a big deal. Because, you know, the bigger thing is going to be how AI impacts things. I think that what we have this year and what we have had in the previous round of elections is that we are looking at populist elections. And I think more interesting is the, if you were to look at previously all the populist elections that have taken place back through, I think, till the 1960s, and you pull out all the years that you've had periods of high inflation and populist elections, there's a very interesting statistic that I heard somebody pull out, and that is each of those cycles, those election cycles, are identified by markets that are in double digits. So you think about even last year's elections, I think the markets were up 21%, thereabouts. And we're having yet again another set of populist elections in other parts of the world as well, but in particular in the US. And so I think the really interesting thing there is what's going to happen to you know, the markets this year. And my sense is that unless we get a major change, such as like a pivot from the Fed that is really unexpected, or some other unexpected event, you know, the equity markets are likely to be strong into, certainly up until the US elections, and we'll see what happens thereafter. But it's an interesting aspect of how to think about what's going on in the world globally right now, is that because there's a very strong populist element to it.
So just sort of on a very simple level then, and I appreciate oversimplifications may not be ideal for you, it's a case that there is sort of a political overlay to the fiscal policy, in the sense that there may be rate cuts sort of ahead of the elections because they're elections?
I don't think so much. No, I don't think the Fed is that, you know, linked to the political side of things. I think more to the point that they would choose to take any action far enough ahead of the election so that their actions are not muddled in with what's happening at election time. But having said that, also, I think they are, you know, it's probably, although their mandate is, of course, to follow inflation and the labor market, I think they are also very mindful of the fact that they don't want massive volatility in the markets at this time. And so typically you should look at what the Fed does through, you know, the lens of inflation and in labor markets. But I think there's also a case to be made for looking through it looking through a financial lens when thinking about what they might want to do. And with respect to, you know, the ultimate outcome of the elections, you know, what I said earlier, it's a bit controversial, but I was saying who wins is almost irrelevant in that, you know, the Fed balance sheet is still 75% larger today than it was before COVID. And that's even after, you know, the QT that's been happening up to now. The demographic forces whereby we have this aging population continues to be an issue. We're going to continue to get debasement of currencies. You know, this debt is not going away. I think you're going to continue to see the path of crypto being one that people are following. That's, I don't think, going to go away. If anything, it's going to become more embedded into, more accepted and perhaps grow towards a point where it'll be something that the institutions are able to get involved with more meaningfully. Of course, it's going to have to get bigger before they can do that. AI is still going to be going to continue to impact people's lives. Probably that's going to be a bigger impact this year on people than the US elections will be. And yeah.
Tell us about that, Anna. I mean, obviously the previous elections and Brexit before that saw AI really emerge as being a real influence. So to what extent do you think AI will be as disruptive or even more so this year, this time around?
Well, I think what's different about last year versus this year is that this year you're not going to be able to take for granted that anything you see is true. You know, even within the year, we're going to see such improvements in AI. I mean, this is happening not on a year-by-year basis. It's happening on a quarterly basis, these advancements that we're seeing. And so ultimately, everything is going to have to be double, triple checked. You know, fact checking is going to be so, so important. And I think just the messaging, you know, to the extent that the population can be educated around fact checking anything that they see on social media or hear on the news, it's all up for grabs in terms of being completely manipulated. So that's going to be the thing that people have to grapple with. I think there's already companies out there that are working on technology that is anti-deep fake. And, you know, I know I've heard rumors that, you know, the Pentagon is already working closely with a lot of these sorts of companies to try and offset that impact. But I think you just need to take a grain of salt, you know, what you're hearing, what you're seeing everywhere. And, you know, also the other thing that's increasingly different is that certainly from a social media perspective in how that overlaps with the financial market, Twitter has become a very widely used information tool in financial markets. So it's in some cases, it's actually, you know, outrunning Bloomberg in the sense that news at times can be reported more quickly on Twitter than it's reported on Bloomberg. And of course, any social media outlet is a huge, it's a sitting duck when it comes to disruption from AI. And so I think that's the thing that we have to kind of, you know, have in mind when we're thinking about, you know, how we're reacting to what we're seeing around these elections. And it's going to be, you know, people, as I say, it's a populist era that we're in globally, and people will be susceptible to being manipulated and, you know, having their emotions played with in subtle ways that we're unaware of.
And you've mentioned AI in relation to at the top when we asked you about portfolio risk, and you linked that to cyber, and of course, you mentioned how that might influence people in the elections and their perceptions to global events because of the ease of which you can now fake information. But it also seems to be able to move markets with fake information. And you mentioned Twitter there, and it may or may not have been on Twitter, but it was somewhere last year where I believe it was a faked photo of a terrorist attack or an explosion at the Pentagon was uploaded and then was briefly reported on a major news site before, and which, you know, which obviously had an immediate impact in, you know, on US markets before it corrected. And although it may have been a bit of a flash in the pan, it was clearly an example of that, you know, that was a year ago. And as you say, you know, that was light years ago now in terms of how this technology is progressing. So it seems like it's going to affect everything. It affects how you are going to manage your portfolio, how you manage you know, again, like how do you go into pricing in an election, but with the overlay that malicious actors might swing it away from what your fundamentals are telling you? So is it just everywhere all the time that you're considering this as a risk?
I think it is, you know, I think it is everywhere all the time. I think there's, you know, you don't hear about it, but I think, you know, the people that are working in sort of staying on top of this from a security perspective are, you know, they're hustling, you know, there's constantly things on the radar for them and having to try and stay in front of it. And I think, but it's going to be, you know, an ongoing effort. However, now, so of course, there's the impact of the elections and to the extent that AI can influence that. But as I said earlier, I think from a financial perspective, the ultimate drivers of what is, you know, driving the secular forces in markets is not going away. And that's almost independent of AI. It's independent of the outcome of the elections. And these are, you know, it's the fact that we're going into an environment where it's away from a demand economy into a supply economy, towards deglobalization in emerging markets, aging population. So there's broader things there at play, which are AI independent, in my view. Now, it is true that I think we have a larger proportion of retail participation in the markets. And again, retail, that makes me think of, you know, people at accessing markets through retail are probably using, you know, broader based platforms, you know, Robinhood or using Twitter, you know, using social media. So to the extent that AI can be disruptive in those ways, then you can potentially see, you know, some reactivity in the markets. And you probably will see, I think the one thing AI will do is cause more volatility in that sense. But to the extent that you are looking at broader, longer term trends and or have the appetite to kind of sit through that kind of volatility, then I think that you're going to have more traditional forces also that you can sort of think about. I mean, the way that you look at the world and measure the world probably is changing from a secular basis as well. You know, whether it's the cycle, the business cycle, everything. And these are for the other dynamics I was talking about. But those are not sort of a result of anything nefarious through the AI world that we're looking at here.
The annual AIMA Next Generation Manager Forum 2024 returns on Thursday, 23rd of May, in London's Mayfair District. Throughout the afternoon, discussions will focus on overcoming asset raising challenges, assembling the right board of fund directors, intelligent automation, and more. The half-day event will complete with a networking reception open to all AIMA members, event delegates, asset managers, and allocators. This is a prime opportunity to connect, learn, and network with senior individuals at alternative asset management businesses. To learn more or to book your complimentary place, visit aima.org. We hope to see you there.
And there is an even bigger trend, as you allude to, which is taking effect in global financial markets, moving away from that policy of globalization towards a trend of deglobalization. You know, what can you tell our listeners about what's happening there?
Well, it's basically, you know, in part it's the Ukraine war has you know, accelerated this somewhat. Obviously, there is it woke everybody up, particularly in Europe, of the danger of having too high a dependence on things such as energy, and you know their dependence on Russian oil, and so. But that, you know, was happening already before. You know, the U.S. they used to be oil dependent. Obviously, now they're net exporters of oil. And so, I think globally, you are seeing the developed world move inwards and look to reinforce their own economies. And so, you're seeing whether that's you know, from being energy dependent or having their a little more independence within their own industries, that they're getting a lot of redundancy build up now. So you're seeing that in China, you're seeing that in the US, you're seeing that Europe is thinking about, you know, being standing on its own two feet from a defense perspective, and they're starting to think about things a bit differently. And that's partly being fueled by the populist movement, that's partly being fueled by the way that the economies are growing. And you're going to continue to see that, I think, the deglobalization in the developed world. And China, for example, is focused very much on building up strategic strength, whether it be in energy, whether it be in robotics, in AI, in tech. That's everything they're doing right now is to become stronger within themselves. And of course, the longer term trend, you could say, is this change in powers globally, in that slowly the US is transitioning out of being the leading power in the world. Slowly, China's becoming stronger. And that is true in the developed markets. However, I think in the emerging markets, you're seeing a different trend. And that is that they are actually becoming more interconnected amongst themselves. So in a sense, they are going towards globalization. And part of what is allowing them to do that is, you know, there's a lot of spending on infrastructure in places like Brazil and Mexico, Indonesia. You know, the bond markets have been very strong in the emerging markets. And that's despite, you know, having the you know, high rate markets that we've seen in the US. And what's happening there is that, you know, China is stepping into a lot of these places as a provider of capital. And you're also getting Russia stepping in as a provider of energy. And to boot, they are now allowing these places to pay for these things, pay back the debt, pay for the oil in their own currencies, which really changes the game for them because it lessens their dependency on the US dollar. And you find that there's a lot more economic activity that's happening in those places as a result. So I think certainly you are seeing deglobalization seems to be the theme of what everybody's talking about. But I think there's an interesting undertone happening in the emerging markets on that front as well. That is the opposite trend.
That's absolutely fascinating, actually, to the divergence there of emerging versus developed markets on globalization, deglobalization. Could you just expand on that a little bit in terms of what that means for investment opportunities? You know, the loss of strength of the dollar and Belt and Roads Initiative from China and everything. Just could you just go a little further there?
Yeah. So from an investment perspective, clearly, I mean, it's already happening. Basically, is you look at, you know, the equity markets in Brazil and Mexico have done phenomenally well, and I think that they'll continue to do well. They obviously have there's been a strong, you know, story for them as well from just a growth perspective. But I think equally you're going to probably see some interesting opportunities in places like Indonesia and some of the Asian countries. You know, I think the whole of the Middle East actually is becoming an area that is increasingly looking amongst its neighbors to do business, whether that be Turkey, India, you know, and so those are going to be markets that increasingly could provide good opportunities, whether it be from equity perspective, whether it be from also bond market perspective. People also say that the bond market, you know, could be much more interesting than some other places. Obviously, China, it depends on what people are allowed to do from a mandate. I know some places, you know, restrict the kind of investing you can do in some of these areas. But those are going to be economies that, because they are becoming less dependent on it, I think the world is going to become more pluralistic in that sense. And so, you know, economies that before were seen as being incredibly volatile, you're going to find some interesting opportunities there. Clearly, India has been a market that people have been looking at and have been investing in already for a long time. And some have sort of said, well, it's too pricey at this level, so not worth looking at. But I think even within that, if you are looking to do a deeper dive into some of the, you know, more esoteric ideas and opportunities there, you're going to still find in all these places interesting stories that could be, you know, interesting investments to look at.
Yeah, we did highlight and spotlighted the opportunities that are taking place in India in a previous podcast. For those of you who haven't listened to it, please look it up, our interview with Shiv Sehgal. Anna, this is all very, very interesting. And what you are saying, it appears, is that this could be the year where we see a reversal in trend. And emerging markets that would have lagged for so many years really benefiting from that. But also, would it be fair to say that this move towards deglobalization will strengthen the hand of US tech firms like the Magnificent Seven? I mean, can we see the Magnificent Seven rallying further still? And in light of what we said already in the episode, set against the backdrop of interest rates being higher for longer, you know, do you think that the S&P and that Magnificent Seven, you know, that rally is going to sustain?
So I think in any rally that you get, it's ultimately there's a digestion period, and you get it's whether the digestion is a bit of a retracement and then continued move upwards, or whether it's just a sideways movement for some time. You know, I think we're seeing that now in those markets, and even in Nvidia, you know, it has paused even ever so briefly. But So in short, I do think that this is going to continue. And I think it's because we are entering kind of a new era. I think these tech stories go beyond just like Nvidia is, and I don't pretend to be a tech expert. So let me just say that at the outset, but I do listen to some people I think are very, very good in these markets. And, you know, listening to them, you know, Nvidia is not just about, you know, what the what it can do for all the AI markets and the need for the GPUs and everything like that, but it's also the software component. So it was pointed out to me just recently that Apple recently has done a deal with Nvidia to help for Nvidia to basically help write software for one of their products, and so that's very unusual. And so what I'm saying is that there's demand embedded within some of these companies that people are still not appreciating. And I think there is going to be, particularly those involved in generative AI, you're going to continue to see strength in some of these markets. And to the extent that the US increasingly is looking to become strategically more independent in the semiconductor market, they're going to try and, you know, get up the curve and be at the level where Taiwan is, and ultimately, hopefully for them, become better or as good as the companies out of Taiwan. As they develop that independence, I think, and I think they will, I think that's where everybody's trying to get to, I think China included. What's going to happen is you're going to see, I mean, Taiwan's clearly from a location perspective still has geopolitical interest for the US. But part of that geopolitical interest, or part of the interest that the US has in Taiwan, is that semiconductor industry. And as the US becomes independent and can kind of stand on their own 2 feet, then it's an interesting question as to how important Taiwan remains for them. And that, I just throw that out there as to be provocative. But the short answer to your question is yes, I think it will. They will continue to be strong. And there will be a race to get faster and faster, not just in tech, but also in the strategic areas like energy. And we're already seeing that in China. China is actually trying to approach the nuclear industry and ways of the technology used in nuclear energy different from what the US is doing, and some would say in a much more efficient way. So that's going to be a very interesting space to watch as well.
And bringing all of this into the lens of a macro fund like Shikuma Capital, do you feel that there is a good opportunity set for macro investors this year?
Well, you know, people use macro very broadly, and it depends what you mean by macro. You know, so in last year, you know, people who were playing rates, you know, who were doing the carry trade, so borrowing Japanese yen, buying Brazil rail or something similar like that, you know, in 2023, they did amazingly well. And that's a macro. Those are macro strategies. Other macro strategies can be more momentum CTA based, and those groups did very well in 2022 when you had everything basically going north, you know, all these very strong macro trends, you know, from a momentum perspective. You know, you've also got systematic strategies, which in and of themselves can be broken down into strategies that are based off of economic data versus price data, short term, long term. So there's a lot in there that you can pack into macro. And I think it depends which macro you're talking about. I think the kind of macro that does trend following, you know, I would want to be careful, because we've had very heady markets. I think, as I said before, I think the equity markets will continue to be strong this year, but I think that's not going to be without some kind of digestion retracement. And so I don't think we're going to get the same kind of movements that we had in 2022. I think we're going to have a volatile year. So to the extent that the macro strategies have are more model based, you want to, I think shorter term models will probably fare better in this kind of environment than models that have a 6 month kind of turning cycle and looking at economic data. I think those will be are likely to get whipsawed as they did, in the second half of 22 and into 23. So it really depends, but ultimately macro has been an area that tends to do well when there's volatility, when people can get their heads around, what is likely the likely outcome. Now, back in the years, the good old days of Soros and Druckenmiller and the Tiger Club and what have you, that they had big ideas about what would happen in the markets. And I think, you can still have these dislocations that provide opportunities. And I think from that perspective, it could be an interesting year for macro. I think the risk that macro has is the disruption that AI could potentially cause in how some of these opportunities or dislocations are being perceived and how they ultimately play out. So that would be the one thing I would just point out. And also I've heard this year being referred to, or the future that we're looking at from this point being referred to, is what's called the VUCA future, V-U-C-A, which stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. From a political perspective, from geopolitics, market perspective, we've got populism, inflation, deglobalization, wars, whether they be economic, hot, cold, commodity supply, you name it. And so the predictability of macro is very tricky right now. But ultimately, where there's risk, if people feel that there is some level, if they've got an edge on things, I think they will have a good year, in macro.
And looking across the various investor surveys for this year, global macro features among the most popular strategies. Why do you think this is? What's the great appeal for the global macro? I mean, you touched on it, there are systematic and there are discretionary macro managers out there, but why do you think it's of such an appeal right now?
Well, I think macro, frankly, has always had this appeal. It's people love storytelling, and macro is one of the most intuitive strategies when it comes to, it's interesting, often involves, things happening in the world. It often, things that people can get their heads around, and investors like that. And also, on average, most assets hate volatility. Macro on the whole does well in volatile environments for the reasons that I just explained earlier. And so typically investors would include macro in their portfolios as a diversifier. So to the extent that there's volatility that might impact, say, an equity strategy or a bond strategy, one of the other strategies that they're involved, or if they're, if they're long only investors, I'm talking from a hedge fund perspective, but from long only investors, even more so, because they don't have the opportunity to go to hedge and go short. Macro then provides a nice diversifying opportunity for them. From 2010 to 2019, it was an interesting period because macro then really struggled to print a double digit return. We had this period that I mentioned earlier, the Soros's, those grand old days of macro when we had these phenomenal numbers. And what happened is they did phenomenally well, and those kinds of returns ended up attracting a lot of institutional money into the field. But what the institutionals were looking for were some kind of hedge to their equity markets and the equity buckets. And so they started to put pressure onto macro to do less of the big swinging volatile type trades that Soros did back in the day, and increasingly do sort of relative value trades and things that would be a hedge against the equity markets. And as a result of that, and also given the low rate environment that we had, macro returns became very, very subdued. And what we've seen in these last few years is that in the higher rate environment, of course, macro has had a rebirth. And so that's another reason I think why people are particularly looking at macro, is that we're now back into a high rate environment. And to the extent that you can get that independence of thinking away from, the relative value type macro, which is not really what macro was once upon a time, then I think that's very interesting for investors.
And we would be remiss if we concluded this episode without asking you about your own firm, Shikuma. So would you mind just telling us a little bit about your firm and maybe also, the interesting name and actually if you could also just tell us a bit about your own and, you know, entry into the alternative space and how you've ended up where you are.
Sure. So Shikuma, basically, we launched Shikuma. There's four of us who co-founded it. And our idea was to try and, set up a way of managing the portfolio, the macro, look at the world from a macro perspective, the way that we would choose to invest our own wealth effectively. And so we didn't really want to be boxed into any one. All of us come from a hedge fund background and have been in the hedge fund industry for over 20 years. So we're kind of veterans here. And we've seen how the industry has become more and more institutionalized. And we really did wanted to get away from that and go back to the roots of investing for the sake of having ideas that we thought were compelling. And we didn't want to fall into the trap of being boxed into any one type of macro, any one type of category that was being sort of overset as a template from some larger institutional investor. So we have, several sides to our bow. We have, we do some models. In fact, a good portion of what we do now is models. And that happens to be what we're focusing on now. We also have discretionary in our portfolio, and we will up or downsize those allocations to either side, depending on what we see and what we believe to be right. In fact, we're not by any means, perfect at this either. Everybody, I think ultimately the thing, if you're going to be an investor, you have to first start by being humble. And any time the ego starts getting in your way, that's the biggest risk that's out there, frankly. And the markets are the biggest teachers in humility, and that continues to be the case. We got it wrong in a big portion of the second half of 2022 and some of 2023. Again, we got some of our longer dated models did not fare well in the volatility that we saw there. And equally, there's other times where we probably could have had some more calls on the discretionary side. But the way that we look at the discretionary investing is that if we find things that are very compelling, we will happily go into those in a meaningful way. But we don't want to feel that we have to get involved in something that we're not 100% sure about, or don't feel that it's not, our gut feeling is that we just don't want to put our money there. So we are very flexible in that sense. The name Shikuma comes from, effectively, the kuma is the Japanese word for bear. And we like the bear as an image of how we think about markets, and that the bear is very adaptable. It can be an omnivore, it can be a carnivore, it can hibernate, it can climb trees, it can swim. It can be very aggressive, it can be very gentle, it's very dexterous. And so that the imagery around that we very much liked. But we just couldn't bring ourselves to call ourselves Bear Capital. Just wouldn't do well. And so all the Greek gods and Latin names were taken. So we steered towards trying to find the word for bear in a language that we liked, and it just happened to be the Japanese word. And she is the number four, so Shikuma is where it comes from. And as far as how I got into this business, I'm Canadian by birth, and I started working after graduating I graduated in economics, and I was actually did my my year off backpacking around the world. I had wanted to be a diplomat at the time, and so my mission was to pick up as many languages as I could. And I was on my way on a round the world ticket to Germany, and happened to stop over back in my homeland in the west coast of Canada, and I was just really applying for a summer job there so I could make some money before I carried on to Germany. And I ended up landing this job on a private island for this couple, business couple, who were very close friends with Bill Gates. And they had on their private island this small office that was wired into their offices in New York and wired into their offices in Seattle. And it was like I would take a motorboat to work every day, and then a golf cart up to the office. And then you'd walk into like this mini Wall Street. And that was completely unexpected. I was looking for some summer job, and that opened a whole new world for me. And it pivoted my interest away from being a diplomat into getting into markets. And I ended up staying there for 2 years working for those people. And they were involved in everything from trading markets to private equity. And from there, instead of going back to Europe, heading for Germany, I headed for London. And within the first year, I was in the hedge fund business in London. It was the Wild West then. you know, there was people were just getting off the ground. And so I got into that arena very early on, and through a very unexpected way.
Anna, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. There is so much to consider, and I know we've been looking for someone who's able to very articulately explain to us and our listeners all the things that are factoring into this year, and you've done that beautifully, and particularly the outlining the double-edged sword that is AI, both from an investment opportunity but also a major and growing risk. And when it comes to let's say the political, the economic, the technology, everything else, I know we say this a lot, but we really could speak for another 2 hours. I would just pick your brain all day, but I appreciate you've probably got other things. Well, I know you've got many other things to get on with, so we will leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us on The Long Short.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
The Long Short was brought to you by AIMA, the Alternative Investment Management Association, the global representative for the alternative investment industry. As always, you can get the latest episodes by subscribing to The Long Short on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music, or by streaming episodes directly from our website, AIMA.org. Thanks for listening.